dental casualty versus staffing concepts. Mr. Gorenberg.
Thank you, Your Honor. Please, the court. In response to CNA's lawsuit to collect amounts due under certain insurance policies and related finance agreements, Staffing Concepts International and three of its subsidiaries filed affirmative defenses and counterclaims alleging that its claims were mishandled in violation of the standards.
I think your appeal is premature because although the judge said, you know, he's striking the demand for arbitration, which he shouldn't have said, it seems that what he was trying to do was saying that before he issued an order to arbitrate, he had to satisfy himself that he had personal jurisdiction right over the parties. Otherwise, couldn't do anything, right?
That's what the court seemed to believe, but, Your Honor, respectfully, the district court was wrong because I think he misunderstood who the parties are and the way they're aligned on the defendant's side.
How can the district court be wrong, at least in principle, in wanting to be sure he has personal jurisdiction over somebody who might be subject to the order? Sorting out the parties might be part of that, but I don't see how that, in principle, is wrong.
They would not be subject to the order because these affirmative defenses and counterclaims, and therefore our arbitration motion, were brought and directed by and against defendants who have admitted that they are subject to personal jurisdiction.
Well,
in
but
Illinois.
Still, the judge, I mean, in the Middleby case and other cases, the judge thought that it was important to sort out this one, it's not really a housekeeping detail, it's a fundamental question about the case before he moves on. I mean, judges can't instantaneously rule even on arbitration motions. It takes some time to make sure that the case is being properly handled. Obviously, there are tremendous disagreements between the parties about what this case really involves and what it doesn't. I mean, it struck me that you're premature as well, I have to say.
Your Honor, this court already has addressed almost identical
circumstances. That's not true. Look, even if the judge was wrong about personal jurisdiction, there's a big difference between a judge who says, look, I'm not going to rule on your order to arbitrate because, you know, there are things bothering me I have to sort out before I can do that. That's one thing. And, of course, if he delays for, and he says, I'll revisit the issue in 5 years, well, sure, you could appeal. There's a big difference between that and his saying, look, I don't think this is an arbitrable dispute, so I'm not going to order arbitration. Then, of course, you can appeal.
Your Honor, the Federal Arbitration Act in Section 16 makes no distinction between...
Let's be realistic. Do we have to have appeals every time a judge doesn't rule on a motion for arbitration in the 5 minutes after it's filed?
Of course not, Your Honor. But
of course not. So what do we do? Draw lines?
In this case, all we need to do is look at the actual circumstances.
Why didn't you wait? What's your hurry?
My hurry is that the court had set an August 2nd discovery cutoff where he was going to require all of the merits.
And explain, you know, that he shouldn't order arbitration. He shouldn't order discovery bearing on the merits of the issue because if it's an arbitrable issue, there shouldn't be discovery in the district court. He should just order whatever discovery is necessary to resolve these threshold issues, you know, like personal jurisdiction. Did you say that to him?
That was, in essence, part of our motion in the first place.
That was in essence. Did you say to the judge when he ordered this August 2nd discovery, did you say to him, look, it's inappropriate to have discovery on the merits because it hasn't been determined yet whether this is an arbitrable issue?
Your Honor, the original discovery cutoff was set before these defenses and counterclaims that we contend are arbitrable.
But that doesn't answer Judge Posner's question. Did you come back and then file a new motion for a postponement of the August 2 deadline?
Because when we file the motion to compel arbitration, that accomplishes it.
No, it doesn't. Not if the judge says there's a personal... I mean, once the judge alerts you to the fact that there's a personal jurisdiction issue that's concerning him, that's the moment when you are alerted to the fact that your arbitration motion hasn't done what you hoped it would do, which would have been an immediate order to arbitrate, and instead now you've got to deal with this August 2 cutoff. Did you ever tell the judge, please postpone that because we have now this not so easily resolved arbitration issue.
That was a piece of the motion that he struck, and he struck it before we could even come in and present it. And then when we came in, after the appeal commenced, and we asked him to stay discovery for the same reasons, including that this appeal had already commenced, he refused to do so.
I'm trying to understand if the district court stays discovery on the counterclaims and affirmative defenses, are the CNA insurers harmed in any way by refiling the arbitration motion after the personal jurisdiction and venue motions are decided? Where's the harm here?
The harm, as articulated by this court in several of its opinions, has already been to say that when you have a right to arbitrate, that includes the right to conduct the discovery in the arbitration, subject to arbitration rules, subject to the authority of the arbitrators, totally different from discovery under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure in front of a district court. It is, in essence, saying you're going to wind up litigating the case entirely on the merits to conclusion.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
But the claim service agreement simply says that the procedural rules applicable to arbitration will be in accordance with the AAA rules. How would that be clear and unmistakable evidence that the parties intended for arbitrators to decide arbitrability? I mean, how does the judge know this?
It's not a matter for the judge to know that until he looks at the rules themselves, which we presented to him in
our
motion.
Wait a minute. I mean, I think we're getting ahead of ourselves here, because I think, first of all, there's this question whether this appeal is premature. That goes to our jurisdiction. Does it fall within Section 16 of the Federal Arbitration Act? If we're going to go beyond that and say, well, let's assume for the sake of argument that we do have the appeal, the next looming issue that you do not really address too much in your brief is that in order for there to be an arbitration, there has to be an agreement between the two parties. Having non-parties arbitrating non-parties is something that the Supreme Court has told us in cases like First Options and the like is an extraordinary thing. Arbitration, the court tells us over and over again, is a creature of agreement. And you are here in the somewhat odd posture of trying to compel all sorts of parties who never agreed to arbitrate anything to force them into arbitration. That's a big problem, too, if we get beyond the jurisdictional issue.
So, Your Honor, which issue would you like me to address right
Whichever
now?
You like. I mean, okay. You can continue on jurisdiction if you like, or we can do a, for the sake of argument, discussion of forcing people who've never agreed to arbitrate to arbitrate.
Well, and Your Honor, I think you've hit the issue right on the head, because it's not a matter of forcing anybody.
Yes, it is a matter. They're non-signatories. People didn't sign anything.
But they're the ones who came in and asserted rights to a contract to which they are not a party.
So what? It doesn't make it an agreement to arbitrate. They might have some theory under, and otherwise they just lose on the merits, and I'm sure you would be happy to defend on the merits that they don't have any rights under these finance agreements.
Of course, but that right is something that we believe it needs to be vetted in the arbitration.
Where is the agreement to the forum?
The agreement is this very contract, and the estoppel doctrine.
People who never signed a contract are suddenly,
The estoppel doctrine, as articulated by this circuit and all of its sister circuits, has always said that when you apply the estoppel doctrine by or against non-signatories, that satisfies the agreement in writing requirements of Sections 3 and 4 of the Federal Arbitration Act.
I think you're way over reading those cases, actually.
Then, respectfully, Your Honor, I don't know how any non-signatory could ever be bound to an arbitration.
Very easy. You sign something before the arbitration, or there are some instances in which you actually satisfy the very stringent requirements of state law for third-party beneficiary status, which is not the easiest thing to do, but occasionally it applies. Non-signatories aren't usually supposed to arbitrate. So if you're telling me that in most cases non-signatories don't have to arbitrate, I would say, well, sure, that's because arbitration is a creature of agreement.
Your Honor, this case started with this issue was brought to a head by a signatory, Staffing Concepts International, asserting these defenses and counterclaims against non-signatories on the CNA side.
Well, and there's another issue, if you want to get to international, which is the question, which I think this record is very vague on, whether your clients are actually successors or assigns, because there's no written consent to assign. that I believe exists in this record. If they're successors, that's one thing under the agreements claims plus, that is, to RISCO. If they're assigns, that's a different situation. You're right back in the boat of no agreement.
That, Your Honor, is only as to one of my clients, CNA Claim Plus, and there is no substantive counterclaim against them. The only counterclaim against CNA Claim Plus is specifically to enjoin the pending arbitration between CNA Claim Plus and Staffing Concepts International. It's just another way of saying we have an arbitrability question, which we acknowledge, and that arbitrability question is being addressed by the arbitrators themselves. That's where we believe it should be addressed. It could be addressed, conceivably, in
a
court.
For the arbitrators to address an arbitrability question where there's at least some prima facie indication there might be an agreement to arbitrate is one thing. For arbitrators, suppose a bunch of arbitrators from the AAA decided that they were going to resolve an issue that's pending before one of our district courts where there's no agreement to arbitrate, no nothing. The arbitrators say, yeah, but everybody likes arbitration, so we'll just decide, you know, this case. You need some prima facie hook before you can get into this business.
And that is exactly as was found in the Contech case and the Apollo cases from the Second and First Districts, where the agreement was the same agreement, and there is the allegations in the pleadings, as there are even in Staffing Concepts' own pleadings here, of the relationship, whether you call it successor, whether you call it assignment, because
courts recognize
them. I think
it makes a big difference if it's successor or assign under
very,
this.
Very well, Your Honor. But the allegation, as Contech really honed in on, the key is whether there's an allegation of an ongoing relationship between the parties under the same agreement.
That's
exactly what's happening.
Then everybody arbitrates. You know, you sort of bring in this huge group of people arbitrating, and that's not what the law has said. Let me ask you one quick other question. In Staffing's brief, they say that there is a fairly substantial factual overlap between the issues that you are going to be litigating in the court and that you would like to segregate off to the arbitration. And I would like you to tell me what you think that similarity of issues might be. As I understand it, it's because in the claims processing portion of things, there might be some issues that relate to the finance agreements and whether the finance agreements were actually complied with.
The only issue under the finance agreements that I can understand is related to this claim handling issue is that there is a provision in the finance agreements that relates to the selection of the claim services provider. But the guts of our claims and what the guts of the finance agreements themselves are all about is a much more mechanical process of Staffing Concepts International or its subsidiaries and affiliates paying amounts due under these insurance policies and the finance agreements
so
themselves.
So is it your position that the facts that are going to be introduced and the types of proof in the arbitration are utterly unrelated to the facts that are going to be introduced and the issues that will be explored in the litigation?
There is clearly some relationship because they're all part of a larger insurance program. But I think there is a pretty clear line between calculation of amounts due under these agreements, which is not much more than looking at the bills that were submitted to them, and then separately the issues that they want to address in their affirmative defenses and counterclaims, which is did this third-party administrator, whether it was RISCO, whether it was CNA Claim Plus, mishandle the adjuster's work of determining how much do you pay to this claimant, how much do you pay to that claimant. That is, of course, a prerequisite to knowing how much is ultimately due under these insurance policies and finance agreements.
So it does sort of circle back to the finance agreements.
Right.
Okay.
I have a question about jurisdiction. So the judge, in his May 23rd order, said essentially that the motion for arbitration is stricken without prejudice and may be refiled after court rules on pending motions to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction and venue. So then you filed your notice of appeal on June 22nd. Did you file anything in the district court between those dates, or was this your last filing?
No, that was the last filing.
The last.
As we sorted out what to do in the wake of that.
So you couldn't you have filed something after May 23rd in which you said to the judge, "Well, this is okay, but we don't want to respond to any discovery requests that might duplicate discovery in arbitration if eventually you rule that, you know, arbitration is appropriate."
Your Honor, I think the court striking of our motion in the first place, not allowing us to present it, and then his subsequent act
doing what?
Striking the motion before we were even scheduled to present it to him orally, and then his response later when we brought the motion to stay, suggests that any interim measures we might have taken would have been utterly futile.
No, you must know that the district judges have this unfortunate habit of liking to dismiss things with leave to refile. We've criticized that, right? It screws things up.
Yes, Your Honor.
But they like to do it. They like to do it. So you knowing this as an experienced lawyer, you should realize there's nothing in this order to suggest that the judge wants substantive discovery. He just wants to decide the personal jurisdiction and venue.
Well, you could have asked him. Well, that is what we did.
You know, suspend the discovery date.
And when we
until you've resolved these your doubts about jurisdiction and venue, right?
He asked that question. He refused to do so.
You didn't ask him after he entered his order, which made clear that he was just interested in jurisdiction and venue. And when he says he's striking this without prejudice, right, he's not resolving any issue of arbitrability. So why should he order discovery?
Because he's depriving the discovery has already happened.
So you should have explained this to him rather than running up here and filing these complicated briefs and delaying the whole business.
And the court could have addressed that when we did come back to it. So thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Baruch.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Jason Baruch for Defendants Appellees. It's quite clear that this Court does not have jurisdiction to hear this appeal. In this Court's order of June 29, 2007, this Court asked the specific question why this appeal should not be dismissed, because the District Court's order did not expressly deny the motion to compel arbitration, nor did the judge's order even consider the merits of the motion to compel arbitration in any way. In fact, the district court specifically invited the move-ins to refile the motion once the court had determined the important issue of jurisdiction and venue.
Now, were you pushing merits discovery with this August 2 deadline looming, or what was going on in that respect?
We were not pushing discovery. And in fact, if we had simply been asked to extend the deadline or seen a formal motion to extend that discovery deadline, I can tell you we would have agreed to it. So no, the question is no.
So you were not, in fact, asked?
We were not asked to extend that deadline. That is correct. There was no motion or informal request.
I'm just sort of interested in this. Whether or not the defendants concede that some money is owed the plaintiffs for unpaid insurance deductibles.
The arrangement under the finance agreements it's kind of an odd one where the PEO is insured with the insurers, and the arrangement is that the insurer will pay the deductible portion of the loss basically in advance, and then the insurance company will get reimbursed for the deductible portion. I never heard of the arrangement before until this case, but that's apparently how they do it.
What's the current status of the arbitration proceeding between Claim Plus and Staffing Concept International?
Sure. The current status of that is there's been a bifurcation. We have objected to arbitrability before the American Arbitration Association. And because of that, the arbitrators found it logical to bifurcate the proceeding into an initial phase on arbitrability and an alternate phase on the merits. And we are currently in the arbitrability phase, and we have exchanged discovery in the AAA proceeding on arbitrability.
Is it a single arbitrator or a panel of three?
It is a panel, but there's only one arbitrator who is overseeing the arbitrability phase at this point. I imagine the panel will collaborate and make an ultimate determination on arbitrability, but right now there's just one arbitrator overseeing the goings-on.
Maybe you could answer the question I asked Mr. Gorenberg, which is, since you're the one who raised this, to what extent, in your view, is there overlap between facts and issues that will be explored in the litigation and facts and issues that will be explored should the arbitration go forward?
There is a very large overlap, and the reason for that is the CNA insurers are insisting that staffing concepts et al. Reimburse the CNA insurers for about $13 million. Now, the reason this dispute arose was because the reason that amount is so high, at least according to our position, is that we were overcharged and not properly billed by the CNA insurers. So,
and that's something that arises under the claims agreement? Or, I mean, which agreement is... The claims agreements are the ones with the arbitration clauses. The finance
yes.
agreements don't have arbitration clauses. So which agreement does this $13 million come up under?
Under the finance agreements and the policies, according to CNA.
Mm-hmm.
Their complaint is simply a lawsuit under the finance agreements and the policies that do not contain arbitration clauses. And in that lawsuit, the CNA insurers purport to be entitled to over $13 million in deductible reimbursements.
And so how will that come up in the arbitrations, should there be arbitrations eventually, of the claims services agreements issues?
We don't believe that there should be an arbitration because...
Well, I know that, but suppose you lose on that point. I mean, I'm trying to just get some sense of how this big mess all fits together.
The short answer is it will be a mess. We will have to litigate in federal court the collection of the amount that CNA is after, and then have a different proceeding with just one of the 10 defendants that will litigate the issues under the claims services agreements, which overlap in many instances with the defendants' claims and the finance agreements. It will be a real challenge to try to disentangle all of this.
So is there a risk of inconsistent findings, and could you give me an example of an issue where that risk might exist if there is one?
Sure. There is a risk of inconsistent findings.
And what would one example be?
An example would be, for example, the district court may find that under the finance agreements, the CNA insurers violated the provision that allowed the insurer to select its third-party administrator. Say the district court finds that. Then the arbitrators find that, say, for whatever reason, the claims were not sufficiently mishandled. Then you have a situation where the district court has found a breach of the provision allowing us to select a claims administrator, and then the question is what damages arise from that. That issue as to damages would then be fouled up with what the arbitrators find as to the claims mishandling issue.
Does Staffing Concepts International have agreements with the other defendants to service their claims for them?
Like an intercompany agreement?
Uh-huh.
I believe there is. I've never seen the formal agreement, but I believe there is.
Is there any possible connection between the personal jurisdiction and venue issues on the one hand and arbitrability? Are they completely unrelated?
I'm wondering
about this notion that the non-signatories of the arbitration agreement somehow become bound by it, whether that's connected at all with personal jurisdiction.
One problem that might arise is if the trial court does transfer venue to Florida, then the arbitration would proceed in Illinois in a situation where the court has found that the majority of the insureds, for example, are not even bound to litigate in Illinois. It would be an anomalous result, I think.
Who are the parties for whom the personal jurisdiction issue exists?
All of the defendants except the four who answered. And those four are Defendant Staffing Concepts International, Staffing Concepts, Inc., Venture Resources Group, and Staffing Concepts National. The other six have stood on their objections to personal jurisdiction and venue. And the other four who have consented to jurisdiction are still objecting to venue.
So there's still venue out there for everybody in personal jurisdiction for six?
Yes.
Okay.
And as to the jurisdiction issue, the rule is quite clear. In a situation where the district court does not expressly deny a motion to compel arbitration, there is only appellate jurisdiction under Section 16 of the Federal Arbitration Act when there's no express denial if the movements can show some irreparable injury that arose from the purported delay in not considering the motion to compel arbitration. That rule is clear in this court's decisions of Middle B v. Hausman and the IDS life insurance case. The rule is that they need to show irreparable injury. They have not even attempted to make that showing. It's quite clear that the court has no jurisdiction here.
They hinted it. They don't want to comply with discovery.
That position would have some ground to it if they had done something to try to avoid discovery on the merits issues from proceeding. But as I stated,
discovery
that
ongoing
happened.
In the district court right now while this interlocutory appeal is pending?
No, all discovery is stayed in the district court by order of this court and a preliminary.
Yeah, right, that's what I thought.
Right.
So.
Is that it?
I can go through the analysis as to why the individual counts are not arbitrable. I would be glad to do that. It's up to the court.
Save it for the next appeal.
I would like to mention something as to the issue. When a decision is finally made, who should determine arbitrability? Should it be the court or the arbitrators? As Judge Rovner mentioned, the only rules incorporated in the claim services agreements are the procedural rules of the American Arbitration Association.
But, you know, as I look at those rules, I know that's your argument, but it's not as though the AAA has, you know, Part A, procedural rules, Part B, substantive rules or something. It's you're asking for a much more finely tuned distinction, and it seems to me that Rule 7A is a very clear statement that the arbitrator has the power to rule on arbitrability. The arbitrator shall have the power to rule in his or her own jurisdiction. So I think the question might be whether the standard that First Option sets out is satisfied by something indirect like this. It's not like they put that language right into the arbitration agreement. They put a reference to something else, and then you go find that other thing, and you look up Rule 7, and you see that. So is it possible to satisfy First Options, as some circuits have said, by this kind of indirect reference, or do you really need to put in the arbitration agreement something simple like the arbitrator will have the authority to determine arbitrability?
Yeah, well, let's put it this way. To the extent there's any doubt on the issue, that would negate a finding of clear and unmistakable evidence under First Options. Now, Rule 7, and you're right, the commercial arbitration rules don't specifically delineate procedural versus substance. So the question becomes, what type of rule is Rule 7? Is it a procedural rule or a substantive rule? If you look at the case law that we cite in the brief, the best indication we can find is that a rule that creates jurisdiction is a substantive rule, not a procedural rule, and therefore would be explicitly excluded from the claim services agreements that limit the incorporation to procedural rules. And like I said, to the extent there's any argument or doubt regarding that, there would not be a finding of clear and unmistakable evidence under the First Options case and under the James v. McDonald case by this court. So,
but what in First Options forbids reference to a different document? Suppose it said, you know, see Appendix A, and Appendix A happened to be the AAA commercial arbitration rules. Why couldn't that be clear and unmistakable?
It probably could, and some circuits have found that the incorporation of the commercial arbitration rules is clear and unmistakable evidence because the commercial arbitration rules have that Rule 7. But none of those cases that find that way have a limitation on the incorporation to only the procedural rule. So that's a big difference.
What other of the AAA commercial arbitration rules, in your view, might be substantive? What I'm wondering is, by saying the procedural rules of the AAA, maybe they just meant to say the AAA's rules and just sort of sloppily said, well, they're all procedural, aren't they? Oh, choosing arbitration itself is just choosing an alternative procedure.
Other rules in the commercial arbitration rules that might be procedural.
That might be substantive.
That might be substantive would be, for example, the delineation between the expedited rules and the regular rules. the rules that delineate exactly how much an arbitrator can award in certain circumstances and what the fees are for certain categories of cases. I don't know the exact answer as to what is what, but all I know is that there is some doubt as to that issue, and when there is doubt, the American Arbitration Association is not permitted to determine arbitrability.
But other than Rule 7, what provisions in the FAA rules would be examples of substantive rules that would not be incorporated in the language in the claim servicing agreement that refers to the procedural rules of the FAA?
Yeah, you know, I can't cite one offhand. I hadn't considered how expansive the universe of procedural rules under the AAA rules is, but I'm fairly certain that Rule 7 is a substantive rule. And if I could have a short moment to conclude, we would ask that the appeal be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. The trial court's order was not an appealable order because it did not expressly deny the motion to compel arbitration, nor did it consider the merits of that motion. And in any event, CNA has not shown irreparable harm. As to the arbitrability issue, there's not clear and unmistakable evidence that the parties agree to arbitrate arbitrability. As Judge Wood said, we have, in the majority of instances, a claim by non-signatories against non-signatories. That definitely flies in the face of the conclusion that there could be clear and unmistakable evidence here. And,
okay. And thank you, Mr. Brook.
And this is going to be your career case.
Probably. Thank you, Your Honor.
So, Mr. Gorenberg, your time expired, but if you want a minute, you may have it.
First of all, to respond to the question about whether SCI was pushing merits discovery, they absolutely were. They had bombarded us with a series of discovery requests.
Well, did you ask them to lay off?
Well, when we went into to Judge Guzman, they opposed the request to stay discovery.
But did you ask them? I mean, the district court's rules like the parties to resolve these things themselves.
Right. No, we did not make a request specifically to them. But their conduct subsequently showed that they were resistant to it. And that was solely on these issues related to the
claim
payment.
Maybe they thought you didn't care since you didn't ask.
Again, I think their conduct subsequently would suggest otherwise. The other thing that I want to reemphasize about this entire situation and the involvement of non-parties is that this is, non-signatories to the agreement, is that this is all upon the insistence and the construct of the signatory, Staffing Concepts International, and having its non-signatory subsidiaries sign on to its claims and in asserting all of those claims against a series of non-signatories on our side. If it's not for their pleading and their choice to do that, we don't have any of these arbitrable issues before this court. And the CNA Claim Plus issue is an entirely separate one.
Well, what do you think the non-signatories should have done? They have claims. So what
on their side? Well, it's questionable whether they have claims. If they have those claims, which is something that is a matter of substantive dispute, which we believe has to be handled by the arbitrators, that's what they should have done. Go either to the same arbitration panel or start a new arbitration.
A non-signatory who has a claim, well, why can't he just litigate it? I don't understand.
Because he's making that claim under the agreement that has the arbitration provision in it. And that's what Hughes Masonry is all about.
If you have a contract that has two provisions, one creating various contractual substantive rights and the other providing for arbitration, and someone signs on to the claim part but not the arbitration part, why can't he litigate under the claim part?
That's estoppel, Your Honor. You can't have it both ways.
You have a contract with two different parts, and different parties sign the different parts. So I signed the claim part, but I didn't sign the arbitration part. And the other side of the contract said, fine, sign that. Why can't I litigate separately? I don't understand.
If it were done before
the
contract,
what does estoppel have to do with it?
If it were done before the contracts were entered into, that would be an entirely different situation. They're taking an existing contract that's been out there for 5-6 years that they are not a party to, and they're saying, I now want to sue under that contract. And if they want to sue under that contract, then they have to live by it too, including the arbitration.
Well,
agreement.
What's their basis? If they're not signatories, what is their basis for having a claim under the contract? Is that, are they third-party beneficiaries or what?
They certainly appear to be claiming such, and if not, then maybe they're claiming some sort of assumption or this intercompany agreement that Mr. Baruch referred to, which is not in the record anywhere. Whatever it is, again, they may...
They haven't indicated what their theory is?
No.
Suing under this contract?
They have not, except I think when you read their pleading, the most likely is either third-party beneficiary or alter ego or assumption, something like that, because they are, again, just flat-out asserting rights under these contracts. Mm-hmm. So, again, we appreciate the court's time. We do request that the court find that there is appellate jurisdiction and reverse and have the arbitrability issue resolved either by the arbitrators, by the district court, or, in fact, perhaps by this court itself.
Okay. Well, thank you to both counsel.